To create an artificial being has been the dream of man since the birth of science. The artificial being is a reality, a perfect simulacrum, articulated in limb, articulate in speech, and not lacking in human response. I propose that we build a robot who can love.
Welcome to Now Playing's bonus review of AI Artificial Intelligence.
After I find the blue fairy, then I can go home. Mommy will love a real boy.
A Podbean backer review chosen by Ed Powell.
Man made us better at what we do than was ever humanly possible.
Hosted by Arnie.
If you let me, I'll be so real for you.
Stuart.
Sir, he's a free-range mecha running hot.
And Jacob.
Can you get a human to love them back?
This podcast will contain detailed plot spoilers and harsh language.
Yeah, I don't need to go through it. I was considering it, but I changed my mind.
Listener discretion is advised.
It is not without peril. We will have to journey towards the moon.
Today we're discussing AI, Artificial Intelligence, starring Haley Joel Osment, Jude Law, Francis O'Connor, Brendan Gleeson, and William Hurt, directed by Steven Spielberg. This is your new super toy, and co-host are now playing Arnie
and Stuart.
And this is the co-host who is not a cat, a dog, or a canary, but please still love me. This is Jacob.
We do, Jacob. And we love all of our May patrons. Thank you for joining us yet again for another Kubrickian kind of movie. It's not quite Stanley Kubrick, but following on the heels of Dr. Strangelove, we're in the realm of Kubrick once more with AI. Why are we covering AI?
Because one of our patrons, Ed Powell, donated the amount to pick this movie. It is one that he watches again and again, enjoys every viewing, and he says we've done quite a bit of Spielberg and quite a bit of Kubrick, so why not get this one where it's both together?
Yeah, what is the story of these two coming together? Because that seemed like a big deal with the marketing, like Spielberg was carrying on the legacy of Kubrick with this film.
Yeah, well, it's got a long history, and it was going to be, for the longest time, I believe it was Stanley Kubrick's answer to E.T. He was going to one-up Spielberg by making this film himself, and he had his ideas. But eventually, he realized Spielberg was the guy to do it, and he was going to make Eyes Wide Shut and said, you know what, I'll just produce, and this is the man that should do it. But before anything, I think we should probably talk about the fact that, like all Kubrick projects, it was a book before it was a movie. Or books being generous.
Yeah, I noticed it was based on a short story.
2,000 words, yes.
What is that, like a couple pages?
Yeah, 11, yeah. It's not much of a story in the sense that there wasn't a lot there to build a 2.5-hour movie out of. A lot of this that we're seeing has nothing to do with Super Toys Last All Summer Long. But yes, that was published in December 1969 in Harper's Bazaar. It is the writing of a prolific British sci-fi author named Brian Aldiss. You guys know him?
No.
No. I must confess, I didn't really know him either, other than being the author of The Thing That Became AI. He has a very long career. It looks like within the realm of science fiction writing, he's considered one of the greats. And Stanley Kubrick fell in love with this story. It wasn't his most famous or acclaimed. It was just the one that Stanley read after divorcing his wife and moving to London. I read it. It didn't take long. It has very, very little to do other than the fact that it's got a father, a son, and a mother that are in the future. That's about the only real similarities I can compare here. The joke is nobody interacts. The dad never comes home because he's off working at this cyber tech company, SynthCorp. And he's trying to solve the world's obesity problem for the rich, because most people are starving, but the rich are overeating. So he's got to like develop a tapeworm and have it eat all their fat.
He did predict modern America pretty well there.
Yeah. It's a funny thing. I mean, I really enjoy the story. The wife is at home bemoaning the fact that the government won't let her have a child. They regulate pregnancies. And so she has this artificial son that she doesn't love that much. She wants her child. This robot boy is nothing to her. And David is upstairs years playing with his talking teddy bear, wondering why mom doesn't love him, and refusing to believe that he's an android. He has feelings, so he's real, and he's not like other robots. And the theme of the story is really that what is real? In a world like this, everyone is kind of fake.
When Android's Dream of Electric Sheep come out? Because I do feel like both of these tackle a lot of those same ideas.
Around the same time. I mean, I do feel like it was a movement in science fiction to look at robotics and artificial intelligence. We knew it was coming, like it was happening on a certain level. 2001 came out the year before HAL, you know, IBM was a thing. So it would have been on the minds of anybody future of thinking about human society. And I like the story. But again, I don't see a movie in it. I don't see what Kubrick does when he invites Aldous over in 1976 to have coffee and have a dialogue about how to make a hit. The truth of the matter is Barry Lyndon had come out. It bombed. Kubrick just wanted something commercial. And he would end up making The Shining. But at the time, Star Wars coming out and everything, he was like, maybe I should go back to sci-fi. This guy is a sci-fi writer. He published in his history of science fiction that I was the greatest science fiction writer. That's actually what Aldous said. Because of Strangelove, 2001, and Clockwork Orange, Kubrick was the greatest science fiction writer of his age. All right, well, help me tell another great sci-fi story. And this Aldous guy was like, why don't you do Philip K. Dick? Why don't you do other things? He didn't see the movie in Super Toys, but he got in trouble with his taxes. And in 1982, he's like, I need money. All right, let's hash this out. They got fax machines.
So he's the original Nicolas Cage. He just didn't put out a ton of shit.
Yeah, he sold it for money. He said, I didn't want to part with this. I don't really let my stuff become movies, but it's Kubrick. I need money, and he's going to work with me on writing the script. And same year this is happening, what's hitting movie theaters but E.T. and Blade Runner? It's on their minds. So they're thinking, okay, how do we make Super Toys into something that's like both of those movies? Because again, Kubrick envied the success of Spielberg and wanted to match that. But he also, he wanted to be Kubrick. He wanted to get there in his own way, and he certainly has a less sentimentality. I think we can all agree Kubrick is less warm and fuzzy than Spielberg.
Yeah, I definitely feel like there are parts where I'm like, okay, this is where Spielberg was involved, and here's the parts. I don't know, was there conceptual art? Because we'll go to a city in this movie, I'm like, ah, here's the Kubrick part. Like, things shaped like tits and ass and just sex going around everywhere. Like, here's the Kubrick section of the film.
Well, and I thought that too. There was definitely, when I watched this, I had a very mixed reaction. I will say I've only seen this movie once in theaters when it came out, very eager to see what it was going to be. What a cool experiment to see someone like Spielberg and Kubrick match heads. And I remember feeling like some of it worked and some of it didn't make any sense. The truth of the matter is, what surprised me, Kubrick all along was the one that wanted to make it a fairy tale. It was him that kept saying Pinocchio.
Oh, so I got to blame Kubrick on this. Okay.
Kubrick is loving Pinocchio, and Aldous is like, yeah, that's not what I tried to write, and I don't think we should try to be a fairy tale at all. And the story is dark comedy. It feels much more on par with Clockwork Orange and that kind of wry British humor. So, yeah, he definitely said, look, it's going to end with New York City flooded and the blue fairy coming out of the water. That's got to be the end of the movie. But then he got distracted. He made Full Metal Jacket. He shopped it around to other authors. He actually got Arthur C. Clarke, who did 2001 with him, to do a draft. This other guy, Ian Watson, who was credited as a story guy on this, he wrote a draft. But the truth of the matter is, they never did come up with a script that anybody really liked. And so after Jurassic Park came out, Kubrick just said, you know what? It's Spielberg. It's got to be Spielberg. One of the things that was a hiccup, I think, for getting this movie off the ground, why Kubrick couldn't make it in the 80s, he was determined a robot was going to be his leading man. He was going to get a machine and not an actor to play David.
I was going to say, Kubrick probably really wanted to flood New York for the sets and, yeah, do something crazy.
Yeah, right. Maybe he saw Daryl. Do you guys remember Daryl?
Yes.
Yes.
Which I rewatched for this. I'm like, how close are they? Not very. I will just say Daryl is this story about a little robot boy, but it
doesn't he steal a plane in that one?
Yeah. It feels very much like a Disney
fantasy
movie. It's
Flight of the Navigator, but with a robot.
Yeah. No sex robots in it whatsoever. But yeah, Kubrick had ideas for it, but they never would cohere. And so he was talking to a lot of effects guys. Throughout the 90s, you have all these guys that say, oh yeah, I worked on designs and I designed this robot. If you want to see what the Kubrick movie before Spielberg came on board might look like, Chris Cunningham was one of the artists he worked with who did a lot of music videos. He did this music video for Bjork called All Is Full of Love. You guys ever seen it?
I avoid Bjork at all times.
Oh, I'm a super fan. I love her anyway. But this video, I think you would like it. It's super cold and kinky and Kubrickian. It's two Bjork bots who meet each other and decide to fuck. Like, it's robot sex.
Okay, yes, I do know this one.
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty eye-opening. I mean, the effects are a little dated now and has been several decades, but you can definitely see some of the David robot design in the way Bjork is presented in that movie. But it all goes away when he dies. 1999, he doesn't even get to finish Eyes Wide Shut. AI is in tatters. There is no script. There is no thing to make. Spielberg is grief-stricken because, again, he had been talking for years with his mentor about making this movie. He was going to direct. Kubrick was going to produce. He cleared his calendar. I mean, say what you will. Spielberg cared enough to say, you know what? I just made Saving Private Ryan. I always could do whatever I wanted, but I literally have 90 million projects piled up. But I'm clearing my calendar, and all I'm going to work on is AI. And this is a big one, because I spent so much time talking to Kubrick and don't want anybody else's voice in my head, I'm going to write this script myself. This is credited to Steven Spielberg, the writer, which never happens.
I was going to ask, he's never written one before, right?
Not really. He will improvise things on set. He'll maybe write a scene or a dialogue, but he's not a writer and needs usually good writers to complete projects. So this is quite ambitious for him to say, I'm going to do it all on my own. And I'll just try to help. He wrote two more David stories and like faxed it over to Spielberg and said, you might want to think about these. But I can understand why Spielberg didn't, because they're in the vein of that first story. Like in the second story, basically Monica has her child. The government allows her to have a real life child and it dies. And we get the impression that David killed it. And David becomes fascinated with hurting other things. He kills Teddy. He ends up killing the mother. And the joke is the dad is still at work having affairs and making inventions and never comes home to find any of this out.
This does sound like a Kubrick film, yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. Again, there's a dark sense of humor. The third story, it gets even more depressing. The dad finally gets too ambitious. He's got all these brilliant ideas that get him fired. He's like, all right, I'll finally go home. The wife is dead. His son has been junked in like a junk pile. He goes to get him.
I want this movie.
Yeah, it sounds like a Terry Gilliam movie, not a Steven Spielberg movie. But the joke is he pulls the son out. You think they're finally going to bond and play ball or whatever. And he's just like, no, now I can make a better son out of you. And so he kills David and tries to tinker with his head to make a better child. And so, again, bleak and definitely not the movie we're here to talk about today. Although I suppose AI is plenty bleak.
Yeah, I remember when this came out. And yes, I remember there was hemming and hawing. After Kubrick died, there was, will Spielberg do this? And that this had been going around for so long and the tech wasn't ready. And yeah, Spielberg put Minority Report on hold for this.
Yeah, it feels like it almost came out of this. I mean, the fact that Tom Cruise had just worked with Kubrick, too, like the fact that Spielberg and Cruise ended up working on a dark sci-fi story feels like everyone was, again, the world stopped for these guys and they were going to honor Kubrick, which as a Kubrick fan, I like that. I like the fact that this wasn't going to be some lost project. There's a lot of stories about the Napoleon movie that Kubrick never made or the Holocaust movie that he never made. I would rather see this movie than have it be something that people always refer to, but we never got a peek at. So if Spielberg is the one to have to pick up the camera and do it himself, well, I'm game.
I was very game when this movie came out. I was excited for it, you know, with the name Kubrick behind it and Spielberg. He hadn't made War of the Worlds yet, so he could do very little wrong in my eyes.
Is that really your least favorite, even now?
Yeah.
Okay. But you haven't seen everything.
I mean, I haven't seen Amistad.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a couple I haven't seen.
I mean, Lost World is...
I was just about to say it's almost close, but War of the Worlds is more offensive.
Okay, we've done that show. If people want to know, I like the movie, but yes, you guys really didn't.
But I was at AI opening weekend. I couldn't wait to see what had come out of this. And man, it's one of the few campaigns of its day, advertising campaigns, that was still mysterious. I didn't know what exactly the movie was even going to be. I knew it had Jude Law as a gigolo robot. I knew it had Haley Joel Osment, who I really liked in The Sixth Sense. And I had no idea really what I was in store for. And I walked out of there and never, ever wanted to look back.
See, I started hearing the reviews, and so I'm like, I could wait on this one, because they were mixed, and so I waited till it was available to rent and rented it, and it's one, there's definitely images and ideas in it that stuck in my head. Like, I don't feel like I really determined how I felt about it when I originally watched it, like, decades ago, I guess now, which is crazy to think about. So I was excited to come back to it again, because it was one where there's a lot going on, and I didn't process it all.
I was working at a college, and I actually just went with a bunch of students, and nobody ended up really liking it, but we were all, I think, befuddled. It didn't feel like a Kubrick movie, and it didn't feel like a Spielberg movie. It felt like, yeah, some weird anomaly that met neither of my criteria for those filmmakers. And I think America agreed. It pretty much bombed here. It made $78 million, which is, I mean, the movie cost $100 million, made up its money internationally. It ended up adding $150 more to that. 2 Oscar nominations for effects and score, not for makeup, surprisingly. Lost them all to Fellowship of the Ring. There were fans. There were people that liked it. There were people that were happy about it, but it kind of gets forgotten. Maybe because 9/11 happened, I don't know. But the whole vision that it presented, that world didn't happen. And so it's interesting coming back almost 20 years later, hoping really that I like it a lot more than my mind tells me I did.
Yeah, I mean, Ed is one of those fans who remembered it. He says he loves the end of the film. He loves the score. And again, he keeps going back to it again and again. So that's why he wanted to hear it covered.
Yeah, it's definitely worth considering. Why don't we get into the plot and go through the details of AI artificial intelligence?
In the future, global warming has risen sea levels where coastal cities were claimed by the ocean. But our technology has continued to evolve, and man is now aided by robots that serve our every function, from nannies to, well, of course, sex bots. But Professor Hobby, played by William Hurt, wants to advance robots further, wondering if one could actually be programmed to love. To that end, he creates David, a child robot who's placed in the care of a couple whose biological child got ill and is in cryogenic freeze. That couple was Monica and Henry Swindon, played by Francis O'Connor and Sam Robards. Henry stays cool to David, but Monica eventually warms up to the boy bot and activates the imprinting code that will make David love her. David is also given a toy teddy bear, named Teddy, that belonged to Monica's son. But then the Swindon's biological son, named Martin, awakens and returns home, none too pleased to have to share his home with a robot. Martin repeatedly tricks and torments David, and after an accident causes David to almost cause Martin to drown, Henry and Monica decide to return David to the factory. But Monica can't bear to think of the boy dismantled and erased, so she sets Teddy and him free in the woods. David is distraught. Remembering the fairy tale of Pinocchio, David believes a blue fairy can turn him into a real boy and then his mommy will love him again. On the quest for this fairy, David and Teddy are accompanied by another wayward robot, Gigolo Joe, a pleasure robot who's on the run after being framed for murder, played by Jude Law. The three go in search of the blue fairy, and that trail leads them to the end of the world, an underwater city called Manhattan. There, Joe is captured, but David's journey continues. Atop one of the skyscrapers that poke out of the ocean, David thinks he's found the blue fairy, but he really found Professor Hobby, who had lured the boy there. David realizes that Hobby is about to release an entire line of Davids that look exactly like him, so he jumps out the window into the ocean. Underwater, he finds Coney Island and a statue that David believes to be the blue fairy. He and Teddy stay there for over 2,000 years, David always begging for the fairy to make him a real boy. And during that time, Earth enters another ice age. Out of that Arctic wilderness comes a new species of artificially intelligent robot. These androids are shocked to find a robot that actually interacted with humans, and they revive both David and Teddy. But David still only wants to be with his mother. The androids are able to revive Monica from DNA, but these revived humans live only for one day. David lives his best life that day with Monica, with his mommy telling him she loves him and has always loved him. At the end of that day, Monica falls asleep and dies, and David falls asleep next to her as credits roll.
One of the things Aldous said that he and Kubrick always talked about was, in sci-fi, you don't want to have too much of the background information. Let people figure it out for themselves. You don't want to throw too much of the future at them at the start.
Spielberg didn't listen, huh?
Why didn't Spielberg hear that? Yes. Why did he call up Ben Kingsley to do this completely pointless narration?
Yeah, I feel like this is the difference between a Spielberg and a Kubrick. 2001, Kubrick's not going to tell you anything. You got to just figure it all out. Why is there a baby in space? I don't know. Figure it out. This one, I don't even know if we need this level of detail. Like, okay, some of this stuff is useful, like limited pregnancies, and that's going to explain why they get David later on. But ice caps melting, I guess they want to set up sunken New York. That would have just been a cool image to realize what was going on. They give too much information.
I think it's supposed to sound like a fairy tale, but whoever heard of a fairy tale that starts about once upon a time, greenhouse gases caused the polar ice caps to melt?
What I think we're seeing is a lecture. Ben Kingsley's voice, one of those androids at the end. I think we're in a class where the android is teaching Earth history to other androids.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out that framing device because the narration is going to come back later. And I'm like, who is talking? It's not William Hurt's character. So who is it?
And this kind of narration, we talked about it with Kubrick. I mean, he did do some narration with Dr. Strangelove. There was supposed to be a hell of a lot of narration with 2001.
Clockwork Orange is filled with it.
Yeah. Is Spielberg trying to honor Kubrick by doing this?
I think he's trying to patch holes. I honestly think that Spielberg, not a great writer, we can argue that he's a great director, but not a great writer, has in front of him all kinds of ideas about what should be going on in the world, and unable to dramatize it just feels like, yeah, data dump is the way to go. And again, cut it. Let's just get to William Hurt. And the point is that here is someone who can map neurons and create a new kind of cybernetics. They already have robots in this future. We don't know exactly what year it is, but they don't have robots that have emotions.
Yeah, they could feel pain. We'll see that they have pain receptors, but they can't feel feelings.
I like this opening a lot, where it's William Hurt, who's, you know, a difficult to pin down actor. And I think he plays AI professor very well here, discussing the both technical and moral implications of robots that can love.
Yeah, I think there's some, again, there's interesting ideas here. That's, I think, why this movie is kind of just, you know, kind of floated around in my head over the years, because there are a lot of interesting ideas. Like, you know, we can make a robot that can love or simulate love, but the idea, can the parent love it back? Like, I'm interested in that. Like, what is the human reaction to this thing that's saying, I love you? And again, there's all these little hints of what's going to play out. But I do like some of these ideas that William Hurt's character talks about.
I also think there's a whole lot of homage. I think throughout this movie, the ghost of Kubrick is going to pop up many times. It starts here in the scene where he asks this woman to undress. It's almost exactly like the scene where a woman is asked to undress in front of Malcolm McDowell in Clockwork Orange, but he's been conditioned not to rape her. But because this is a PG-13 movie directed by Spielberg, no titty shot for you.
I thought this might be rated R. I mean, Spielberg has gone R before, but no, not on this budget. I don't know that a studio would fund it.
Well, it's his studio. DreamWorks is relatively new. Spielberg could do whatever he wanted.
Yeah, the opening thing is an Amblin Kubrick production.
Yeah, Warner Brothers, which was Kubrick's home, also was co-producing this thing. But I do feel like Spielberg is always pragmatic. He doesn't want to make an art film that's going to lose $100 million. He's going to try to, again, this movie was supposed to be E.T. I don't think it ever could be that, but that was the conception, that it could be, to the popular taste, what that Spielberg movie from 1982 was. And yeah, you mentioned, do androids dream of electric sheep before? The idea is that if a robot can dream, the line between real and artificial has been eliminated. If it can have an internal life is the definition. Right now, to this Sheila bot, love is a series of biological responses, but if she can have thoughts and ideas and determine her own destiny, then they have achieved the status of God.
And I'm perfectly fine morally with that choice. I think that it's a interesting conundrum. I mean, that is where AI differs. Artificial intelligence is very different from programming. I mean, there is programming involved, but the ability for machine learning and to take it all to the next level and for the adaptability of that. So for adults who maybe can't procreate in a very isolated society that we're currently living in, robot mates, as in spouses, not just as in lovers, seem like that could be, you know, a much safer option than mail order brides from Russia.
Yeah, they don't carry the coronavirus.
Yeah, I mean, it's mentioned they don't get sick, but yeah, the contrast is starkly put out there. There's a designer that's like, we already have robots that love. Well, we're not talking about sex bots. We're not talking about a robot that'll fuck you all night. We are literally talking about in a world, and I wish this got dramatized more, in a world where people are not allowed to have their own children, and we got to think about resources. If we gave them artificial children, then it's easier to manage for everyone. But yes, will it be the same thing for the family that's taking the child in? Is something that I think you could explore in an intimate drama that never goes on a road movie. Like, they could spend the whole time in the household of the Swintons, I feel like.
Oh, yeah, I totally agree. I mean, look, a few years ago, we got Ex Machina, which is all about AI, and that is a movie that's just in a house about artificial intelligence. And like, yeah, it's able to get into that kind of drama. This one, okay, it is a Spielberg movie, so it's got to be big though, right? I'm kind of give it that because I know what the guy does.
Not only that, but I do think Kubrick often does road movies, and I feel like the characters take odysseys and journeys in his films.
I'll say that I would have preferred if it were this family drama. My favorite part of this movie is the first hour where you're really exploring that concept of an artificially intelligent child being inserted into a family life. But I do want to bring up, since they do discuss ethics at the beginning, they discuss the morality of robots that can love.
Yeah, what's our responsibility towards the mechas?
Is there any conceivable justification in your minds? I mean, it's very subjective, but to me, an absolute no is to create a robot child who will never age. You are creating a scenario where you are building a permanent dependent that can never stand on its own. And therefore, while I understand the hole it's trying to fill in the case of this couple whose biological son was stricken by disease, just because it can ease the suffering, is there a moral obligation to both robot and human owner that you're not some 95-year-old old person still caring for a 7-year-old robot?
I will sidestep that question and just say, and I'll frame it in this way. It is how we look at ourselves. We are still a child looking for our creator, looking for that approval. It's why William Hurt evokes the Garden of Eden. God cast us out and we don't know why. The same relationship may happen between us and the children that we're creating. But I think, you know, we don't really understand at this point that William Hurt is trying to fill a void in his life. His son, David, is dead. And it's always kind of weird to me that he ends up creating this thing and then not keeping him. Like, he's cool with, like, let's find a test family. You would think if this is Pinocchio, then he's Geppetto, right? Like, this story that would unfold would be about William Hurt trying to replace his son with a robot, David.
But I think he's a technologist first and foremost, and he also couldn't separate himself enough. He needs to observe this subject in a controlled environment to know if it's actually successful. He may be too close to David, the face, the spirit, the dead child, to ever know whether he was actually successful.
Yeah, Artie, to your question, I do feel like this is version one and William Hurt's character, yeah, this is the experiment. Can he create this thing that maybe will fill this void at some point if the technology goes right? My question is, if you build something that's going to love you no matter what, like, wouldn't that make us monsters? Like, if you just had this child that would, you could beat that thing, you'd do whatever. Maybe I'm going to Kubrick territory here, but like, I think there is a dark side to this, which the films, they're going to hint at it. And I wish they'd get into a little bit more, but there are a lot of interesting ethical questions and dilemmas raised by this.
Yeah, it is a peculiar notion set up, and it seems to be they're going forward without thinking all of this through, although they are thinking it through because they're talking about it before they built it, but it's not going to stop them. 20 months later, They got a prototype, and they're going to find an employee in the company that's best qualified to take it on. And that is Sam Robards and Francis O'Connor. Henry and Monica Swinton are perfect because their child is in cryosleep. And that's different from the story because, again, the couple were mandated not to have children in the short story.
The introduction of David made me think immediately of Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Oh, they make it look like the alien.
Yeah.
That shadow through the glass. Yeah, I wrote that down, yeah.
Yeah, with the long neck and the small head. And he's out of focus, and that distorts his image. And it's going to come back later in the movie. This is what the future androids look like. But it's also what the aliens at the end of Close Encounters looked like, which was my first go-to.
Not only that, it's the first shot in the movie. If you notice, as they pull out of the window to look at William Hurt, there is a statue out of focus through the rain-spattered glass that kind of looks like a bird. It will end up being the first thing David ever sees, but it is a human being with outstretched hands. David, you know, it's the name of the character in the short story, but I wonder if that short story written after 2001 wasn't thinking about Kubrick, right? Dave and Hal, that was such a big storyline. Why else call him Dave? Maybe it's David and Goliath, I don't know, but I feel like it is one of another Kubrick references.
I definitely did wonder if part of Kubrick's, but he was working on this for so long, but one of his ideas was kind of do a retort to Hal, and like, there's that evil AI, and like, just such a great villain, just this glowing red eye, and now here's the other side of robots and artificial intelligence. I did wonder if that was an idea he had rolling around, that he wanted to, you know, be fair and balanced, present that other side.
Yeah, it ends up playing that way, whether intentional or not, I can't say, but yes, if we think about Kubrick and the way that he's looked at technology in the past, it fails, and we have nuclear wars, and we have robots that just go crazy and decide to kill the human cargo. They're never really helpful. They're part of the bureaucracy. So, yeah, it's kind of all kinds of danger and creepy when David comes out of the box and comes home to this family.
And the mother, Monica, is not so game for this. I mean, first of all, it's sprung on her.
Yeah, this is definitely a conversation you want to have with your partner before you bring a child home.
It's not a dog.
Forget about bringing a dog home without consulting them. This is a child.
Mm-hmm. But it was also mentioned that this guy is ready to move on. We had one kind of underdeveloped scene where they go to the hospital and Henry is talking about other things while Monica is going to read children's stories to her son in cryogenic sleep. Probably can't even hear it. The idea is that she's not willing to let go. He is doing this as a way of, really selfishly, I think, so that she can move on because I want to move on.
Yeah, what's so weird is that Monica will eventually imprint on David. Henry never does. Like, he never says those seven magic words.
Yeah, and in fact, likewise with David. David never calls him Dad.
No.
He calls him Henry.
Can David imprint twice? I never got that. I thought David could imprint once.
I would think if you're making a fake child, you want it to imprint on both the partners.
Yeah, I would also think you'd design him to be able to eat food. Because if he's going to sit there and drink fake water and things not on the plate, that is super creepy. I'm sorry, you're not going to bond with that. Eating is a big part of like a shared community experience. And if that, like, you look like you have an eating disorder if you're just sitting there with an empty plate, biting air.
Yeah, well, that's version 2.0. When all you're built is nannies and sex bots at this point, you don't have to worry about spinach on the innards.
I mean, if it's a sex bot, there's other things that are going to be on the innards.
Yeah, exactly. You have a tank, right? It gets cleaned out. Not hard to do.
So, yeah, David being here, it is funny how Monica does come around to him and Henry never really does. But Henry works at the company that built him, too. I mean, did he bring him home seeing a chance for advancement? Like, this is good for his career?
Well, that's what I'm wondering, because it seems like, I don't know how much of this is all planned out, but there was some kind of, you know, we got to see if David will dream and, you know, we're going to find hidden messages and an info booth later on. And it seems like this was all, I don't know, maybe Henry was in on it. Maybe William Hurt like pulled him aside and said, okay, you don't imprint. We just want to see how the mom. And then, yeah, I don't know how much of this was planned to really see how far David would go.
I don't think very much, because the way Monica reacts, Henry's like, we can send him back. We can take him right back.
Yeah, I feel like a writer would ask these questions and develop these characters, and Spielberg is just assembling what he knew Kubrick to want to have in this movie. A lot of what's here are things that Kubrick articulated that he wanted here, and putting it all together sometimes goes against coherence, but Spielberg doesn't want to lose anything. So one of the casualties of that approach is the fact that we have a lot of characters that just kind of hang around and don't do a whole lot. And I think Henry would be a whole lot more useful if he was William Hurt. I think you could just have that story. I'm going to design this robot boy and bring him home to my grieving wife. And that's it. We don't need another family in the company. Geppetto, again, he didn't make a wooden boy for somebody else.
Yeah, I like William Hurt as an actor. It would be very interesting to see him. He's always a cold kind of actor. Him versus a robot would be an interesting dichotomy because they're both rather cold. And do either of them know how to love?
Indeed. Or laugh. Boy, like, again, the thing that charms this family, the reason that they, like, because it's going bad. You can tell the mom is like, send this shit back. I do not want it popping up while I'm doing the laundry and I'm on the toilet and all of this. But because David thinks it's cute that she's got noodles hanging out of her face, she's like, okay, I'll read the protocols to him. I was like, huh? This is the moment?
Yeah, that seemed very odd to me. Like, that's what wins her over.
That laugh is eerie. It's a horror movie psychopathic laugh that David gives.
Maybe she imprinted out of self-preservation. She's like, this thing's gonna kill me.
I think the dad makes that comment. If it knows how to love, it also knows how to hate. Better to be on the other side of that, right? Like, make sure it loves me then.
But Haley Joel Osment, we discussed him with The Sixth Sense. He was an amazing child actor, and he is equally good here. His every mannerism, he is just such an actor beyond his years. And the subtle makeup effect that I don't know that I noticed the first time, but they've left some shininess on his skin, so he looks more plasticky than those around him. He always seems a little bit off, and I really believe his performance. I forget it's Haley Joel Osment, I see David.
Yeah, I forgot that Haley Joel Osment had two great roles, like before he grew up and lost those cute childlike looks that he has here. But yeah, he's really good.
He's okay. I can't be as excited as you guys are. I think part of the problem is he's playing robot. We know what this is. I saw Small Wonder. I know what they do.
This is so much better than Small Wonder. Take that back.
All right, that was a low blow. But my point is, it's what you would expect a robot child to do. The forced smiles, the awkwardness and all. And then she reads this protocol, and then he can't act. Once he's actually able to be David, the problem is, then he's put against a kid actor who is no good, and the evil brother, the Cain and Abel storyline is just, it's unfortunate.
And it's not really well explained either. We don't even know really what waylaid this biological son, and now he's back. And how long has David been with the family at this point? Was he imprinted 2 days ago? Was he imprinted months ago? Time is very nebulous in this movie.
In the story, it was very clear that they had had David for, I think he was, 8 or 9 years old. And the end of the story is, oh, we can have a biological kid. Who cares about this anymore? I never really liked you anyway. I get the sense that it's months. It doesn't feel like it's been too long, but long enough that David is starting to have anxiety about, Mom, are you going to die? You know, you have this scene where he spills the Coco Chanel No. 5 and thinks about her life dribbling away.
It's 50 years, a long time. Again, I like some of these lines and some of these ideas they're getting at, that she is going to die. And like you said, Arnie, what is the duties towards this child robot that's still going to be living?
I think that's why she cracks out the Jiminy Cricket of this movie and has always been a problem for me.
You don't like Teddy?
I can't not think of the Snuggle fabric softener icon when I see this Teddy Ruxpin meets David Lynch.
That's why I love Teddy, because yeah, it reminds me of that Snuggles bear. I don't know. He's got a dark side to him. I don't trust Teddy.
I like the look and the animation of Teddy. I feel like he never actually does much in the story.
No.
He's there so that we can have some expository dialogue.
He's the conscience, you know, Pinocchio, like he was the one that sat on Pinocchio's shoulder and like, you know, you really should go to school. Don't go off with the bad guys. Like he's the one that's trying to keep him on the straight and narrow path so that he will be a good boy.
But I never know how much Teddy really understands either. Teddy is such a rudimentary robot and a toy at that. So you have to assume even the sex bots have more emotional depth. So Teddy is David's ally, but I always wonder how accurate it is to trust Teddy. But he never does anything interesting. Teddy doesn't have an arc. Teddy's just there.
No, he's a Boba Fett, and I'm all right with that. Like, this weird, interesting little side character that, yeah, he doesn't do much, but I like that he's in this film.
He gets pitted between the two brothers because Martin comes home and he's like, come to me and you call to him and we'll see who he likes more. You can just feel competitiveness in Martin's blood. I was here first. It is the eldest child syndrome. I will say, as the younger child, they do resent you. They do resent when you show up, and there are these challenges, and I think in any, hopefully it doesn't look like this.
Martin just feels a little too over the top for me. This kid that was, look, he was dead. That's why he was frozen, because they had to like wait till they could find a cure for whatever he had. And yeah, he's kind of a jerk. And again, there's an interesting drama there. Like, you come home and you find out you've been replaced by a robot and your mom's maybe loving it for real, who knows? And
yeah,
has that replaced you? Like, that, there's interesting stuff here.
Not only that, but like, if you notice, he's got to use robotics to walk. Like, he's like gotten emaciated, like, all that time. His muscles have atrophied. And so, like, he can't swim when he has his birthday pool party and all that. He is kind of crippled. So, yeah, I agree. This is a potentially sympathetic character that gets written as a one-note villain.
Yeah, I would love to see exploration of him, because he has every reason to be pissed off. Because whatever happened when he was put into that cryogenic freeze, he woke up and suddenly he's been replaced by a robot, you know? You think you're mad that they took your job at the factory? Now they've taken your parents. I could go with Martin if he were given anything other than mustache twirling, go in and cut mama's hair off with these scissors and things. As it is, you just kind of want to see David leave him at the bottom of the pool.
Yeah, they could do better. And again, the problem is not the dynamics. Maybe it's the acting. I'm not really connecting to a lot of these performances, but mostly I'm just feeling like these scenes are fragmented and underwritten and clumsy in the way that they're telling us to feel.
And I'm not going to disagree with that. It does feel fragmented. I'm enjoying the ideas. Maybe I'm writing a better movie in my head as I'm watching this, and that's what I'm getting the enjoyment from. But I like a lot of the ideas, and that doesn't make this a great film, but there's interesting ideas I think you could get from watching this.
I'll agree with both of you. I mean, I think some of the performances here are lacking, but I think it's because it is fragmented that it's lacking. I never really get a bead on Henry. I can never follow Monica's emotional through line in any given scene, because there's so much happening in this first hour. It's 30 minutes when Martin comes home, and then we only have 30 more minutes until we got to get rid of David from the house. I think that if we did spend more time here, all these actors, all these storylines could be well served.
Again, there's times when they don't have to say anything, and it's just the way Spielberg shoots it that tells me so much more. Like, you were talking about that scene at the birthday by the pool, Stuart, when David falls in holding on to Martin, and dad jumps in, they save Martin, and you just get that lingering shot of David on the bottom of the pool just, like, looking up. Like, I don't know, to me, that's a crazy, like, weird, sad moment. Like, here's this thing that loves its mommy, and it's just laying on the bottom of the pool, and, like, nothing said. It's just a shot of Haley Joel Osment down there. And like, I think that's where this film has more power than, yeah, trying to do all this dialogue with all this infighting.
It becomes a motif, really, that this child is always arms outstretched, please love me, and never finding it. The middle of this movie will be a quest to, I will become the thing that you will love. All right, I'm going to go after her. Frances O'Connor, like, she didn't do much. She came from a Jane Austen movie, and she didn't do much after this. And I'm having a problem with her.
I knew her from Bedazzled, that Brendan Fraser movie. She was the love interest.
Yeah, Brendan Fraser makes a deal with the devil, who's Elizabeth Hurley.
Yeah, that movie came out the year before this one, so her face was fresh in my mind, and she's much better in that movie than this one. I actually like that movie, but it's only okay.
The point is that, like, it's real crucial that we love her the way David does, and I don't. Maybe she's complicated, and we see her trying to love the child, just like the character in the short story, and having problems. I'm never with her, and I feel like I wish David could just leave her behind and go have a better movie experience, because to have an edible complex with her is just to have a losing proposition.
But isn't there something to that? Isn't it more tragic that he loves this woman who you don't love? So you're able to feel so sorry for him, because this entire movie, to me, is like a lost dog movie. Because David, despite being an artificially intelligent robot, his unconditional love reminded me of that of a puppy. And so when a puppy has a bad owner, the puppy still loves that owner, and then the puppy doesn't understand why the puppy's being left on the side of the road to die because the owner's a bad person, it makes you feel even worse for the puppy.
I thought for sure she was going to play hide and seek and just get in the car and leave him, right? Like, she was going to really just leave him out there in the woods. She at least takes the time to explain to him. And again, she's like, well, here's Teddy. Teddy is going to be the thing to take care of you after I'm gone anyway. And it kind of has a Snow White fairy tale quality. You know, the huntsman takes Snow White out to be slaughtered and then chickens out. That's kind of where we see David here at the 50-minute mark. Kind of, yeah, on his own. I don't know why he believes that a blue fairy is going to make him real and loved by her. She read the Pinocchio story to Martin. She never talked about Pinocchio with him. And I don't know how Martin convinced him of these delusions he has about her love.
Yeah, okay, Stuart. This is the biggest problem for me in this movie. And you're saying this is Kubrick's idea to do this whole Pinocchio metaphor, which I just hate. It's too obvious.
It may be too obvious, but I mean, it is a story about a wooden thing trying to be real. And that is the story of robotics.
I get that. It's just an obvious metaphor. I was for sure I thought this was Spielberg. And look, I got to criticize Kubrick. This was idea. I don't like it. I wish that was left out because, yeah, you could do a fairy tale. You could make it a Pinocchio story without saying, hey, this is a Pinocchio story.
Maybe they should have. Or, you know, just one scene of her reading Pinocchio. Like, I feel like they really hammer it in. It's just not a lot of grace to the writing.
I mean, Blue Fairy is like in every other line of dialogue in this film.
It is the guiding principle of Act Two. This Act Two thrust is, I must find this thing that will make me loved and make me be able to return to this mother in a way that she will accept me. Because the only reason she doesn't is I'm not real. And I guess it could be one scene. If he had overheard after the pool party that went so south, that she had to make the decision between the two children, and she said, I have to go and protect my biological child because this kid is a day. It's all done through inference. And again, I feel like maybe they could have even written it like David did go after Martin. The fact that he hugged him and they accidentally fell in a pool feels like cheapening out. Why don't we have Cain and Abel? Why don't we have him finally pissed off and do something to this kid? I feel like all of this is frustrating to me, but I definitely feel like she needed to verbalize that she is going to pick her real child over the robot child. And then that would give him the motive that he has.
I'm not even sure that she did pick it. The husband decided to bring him home. The husband may have unilaterally decided to send him back. But I do have a question. Because David, from the moment he's imprinted, has one goal. Mama, love me. I want to be real so you love me. Does David have a character arc?
I mean, why is that not an arc?
It's static from beginning to end. He never evolves past wanting that love of the mother. He never learns anything.
Well, he becomes real. I mean, I think that the arc is he does become, he follows his dream and he becomes what he feels he needs to in order to get what he was looking for.
Yeah, he'll be the connection to fleshy humans in the future. And I feel like that's how he becomes real in this film.
Yeah, I mean, that's getting ahead of ourselves. But I hear what you're saying. He's not a really complicated character.
Yeah, I would say, is he artificially intelligent? If you just have an unconditional love, look, I know dogs are intelligent, but a dog's love for you is different than a real human relationship where it's complex and you have trials and you learn. I have a hard time that it's just this unconditional love and that's somehow going to lead him to dream and that's artificially intelligent. That, forget about his character arc. That, I don't know how much intelligence is here in this artificiality.
Well, he's a child, though. That's the other problem, is they've programmed him to always have the intellect of a child.
Yeah, I don't know. They say he will never get sick and that he will stay the same size. But I would imagine if you live 100 years, even with a child's mentality, you would change. You would be different than you were on year 5.
Especially if there's AI involved.
But if it's in your programming to not be, there's these directives, you know?
Do they program that into AI, though? Like, I thought AI, the point was, it just goes out and does its own thing.
I think emotionally, he's stunted, but I think that intellectually, he can gain hundreds of years of information and is obviously smarter than a lot of them already.
But at this point, we cut to another one of them, Gigolo Joe, Jude Law. We had to wait an hour to get him in this film. I still don't know why he's in this film.
But I do definitely, you know, you talked about the subtle makeup on Haley Joel Osment. I feel like with these other mechas, these older versions, I do like this makeup work. Like, they do give them a plastic look, their hair, their skin. And I see that right away with Gigolo Joe.
Yeah, definitely should have been nominated for best makeup. It is striking. And even in the behind the scenes footage, I'm like, how much of this is CGI? No, a lot of that was applied. It was Jude Law wearing a facial prosthetic, and it's a really good looking one. It really does. I hate to bring this up because it sounds like not a compliment, but it brought me back to Heartbeats. If you ever saw that Andy Kaufman, Bernadette Peters movie, it won an Oscar for the makeup effects for good reason. Best thing about the movie. But yeah, why is he in this movie? Well, if you look at Pinocchio, there was that fox character that tried to tempt Pinocchio to not go to school and come to the fair. I think that he's kind of playing the devil on the shoulder. I also think that, you know, David is going to walk through his journey with one hand on a teddy bear and one hand on a sex bot. To me, one of those is Spielberg and one of those is Kubrick. He has guiding influences.
Yeah, that is how I interpret the film.
But wouldn't it be funny if Spielberg was the sex bot and we just didn't know?
You know what? He tells me he's not once we get to the sex city, but we'll get there. Right now, we actually are there. I think this is Rouge City, but we don't know it yet. He is turning tricks in hotels and, you know, he's meeting this lover that, again, she's afraid of his junk because she's never been with a mecca before. Disappointed he didn't use the line, once you go bot, only metal in your slot, but he says something similar to that and ends up on a crime scene.
Yeah, I don't understand why he needs to be framed. I don't think they ever even explain why he's framed.
I don't know why you bring Enrico Colatoni in to be the murderer. I don't understand why you just instantly assume that the gigolo was the murderer and not this guy who apparently had a relationship with this woman before.
This whole subplot is in Minority Report. Remember, there's the whole thing about the guy that abuses children and Tom Cruise goes and he's supposed to go there to kill him and all that. Like,
yeah, but that's actually part of the plot.
Yeah.
Like that plays into it. This doesn't.
No, this is just a noir throwaway. And again, I feel like Spielberg was thinking about Minority Report and taking from it and just grafting a little bit onto here because they need something. They need some reason. It would be very awkward for David just to meet this guy in the forest and not to see him in action, turning his hair blonde, making his palm a mirror, doing the gigolo dance.
I'm glad Jude Law is here, if only for some of the great dialogue he gives. The insight into robotic life all comes from him. That is useful. Jude Law, I love his performance. I love his little head twitch that turns on and off his internal radio. I like so much about him, but it just feels so weird to me that we go from this love me, mommy, to love me, mama.
Love me, mama.
Yeah, he is another Teddy. Like, I don't think he's necessary for this plot, but I don't mind him. I'm having fun with his character, just like I kind of enjoy Teddy in this film.
Again, I think Pinocchio was the way that Spielberg figured out what to do. Like, let's just look at what happened in Pinocchio, and we'll do things that are like there. A flesh fair is kind of like the fair that they go to and turn into donkeys. It's grotesque. So we have the idea that in the future, mankind's relationship with AI, or at least a majority of people, we've only seen these rich people in the ninth house and adopting robot babies. The rest of the world fucking hates them. And they're going to have monster truck pulls where they just totally destroy mechas.
Well, yeah, and I love when they go to round up those mechas. Like, we see a dump truck just dump a bunch of robot parts out, and then these mechas come out and start replacing parts.
Is dumping those parts like chum in the water?
Oh, did you think that was to like, draw them out and catch them?
I have no idea why you dump a dump truck in what is obviously not a landfill.
Well, all the landfills are probably full at this point in this dystopian future.
It could be either way, I suppose, but I took it that we're in a world where robots are so commonplace that they are literally just the plastic plastic bag or the aluminum can. Like, they're just everywhere, and you just fucking throw them wherever you can.
And I want to give the movie this. Like, this is a movie that's almost 20 years old. I think almost every CGI shot holds up in this film. Like, when they're replacing parts here, I think this stuff looks great.
Absolutely. The missing half heads, the missing backs of heads, all of it still holds up. And some of it is like zombie effects when the face is peeling back. But again, you know, the thing I like about Spielberg in general is he always is a mix of practical and CGI, it seems. And that's what holds up best is when you do that. But yes, I have zero complaints about any special effects in this film, and it's 20 years old. I wish I could say that about the Star Wars films Lucas made at the same time.
I'll say this. I agree with you that technically they look good and they hold up. I don't feel like they're very forward-thinking. I feel like this is somebody trying to remake Blade Runner or maybe even like Demolition Man. Like, it doesn't look like a future I haven't seen before.
Yeah, Stuart, throughout this film, like, I was getting angry because I'm like, this seems like such an antiquated idea of AI. And like, if you made this film now, I forgot, it's almost 20 years old. So as a capper to like the 20th century and our idea of AI and robots, I'll kind of go with it. But definitely today, this film would be very different. Yeah, we've evolved in our ideas what robots and AI will do.
But maybe Kubrick was always chasing the tail of what Ridley Scott did in 1982. Like, I feel like there was truly a forward-thinking vision. This is just kind of recycling those parts, maybe adding a few extra here, but it's not blowing me away. I don't feel like when I saw this, I went, wow. I mean, even at the time, I don't feel like, wow, I've never seen this world before. It just felt like any other dystopia from the 90s.
No, I never am as amazed as I am with the opening scene of Blade Runner with a hover car flying over LA and fire shooting out of smokestacks. Like, you're right. Like, nothing's going to blow me away. But when we get to this flesh fair, which is, yeah, Pleasure Island, if you're familiar with Pinocchio, yeah, it's not as forward thinking. But I, again, the idea is like, how would the common people react to these robots? And you'd probably get these weird religious anti-robot cults and things like that. So antiquated, old fashioned, maybe, but I'm still going with a lot of the ideas.
I think some of it is new graphics, but the fact that they're not trying to break such ground works for me. I'm not sitting here jaw-dropping, how did they do that? But it holds up, except for when they decide, you know, you mentioned Demolition Man. I went to the Running Man when these guys in the neon suits on motorcycles come in.
Come on, they got like wolves, like neon wolf heads going on. It's a crazy design. They look like the Tron bikes.
All they needed to do was sing opera.
Spielberg is way out of his element, right? Like, this is something he's never really even done before. And he even talked about in the supplemental material, he wasn't trying to fulfill his vision so much as he was trying to put the movie together that Kubrick talked about. Like, this feels like maybe this shouldn't have been a Spielberg movie. I know he felt like he was the only person that could do it and had been anointed by Kubrick. But yeah, if you want a movie about guys on motorcycles hurting people, you call Frank Miller. Like, you call somebody else. Spielberg doing it feels like a strain. Like, he's stretching and hurting himself.
Did Kubrick not have like any conceptual art or anything like that?
Millions. And a lot of it is. But you got to realize he had like 18 years of this stuff. And what do you pick, and whose ideas were good? And would he have thrown all of it out to go with some new artist the next minute? You know, like, he was a restless soul when it came to finding the right idea, and which is why it took him so long to make movies towards the end.
And yet I felt when watching this that this could be the exact same world in which Ready Player One is taking place. Like, the same kind of aesthetic and feel and silly costumed action people in the real world. To me, this post-apocalyptic future, this dystopian future, felt a step away from the junkyards of Ready Player One.
Yeah, but that's later. And I guess my point is, up to this point, Spielberg isn't someone that thought the future would end up bad. Like, he's an optimist. He thinks, you know, good things happen, you know, be good, and the aliens will be kind. They'll never hurt you. And after this movie, we're warring with worlds, and we've got Minority Report and thought crimes and, yeah, Ready Player One. All that stuff came later. This was the turning point. It was him thinking about Kubrick that made him, you know, maybe 9/11 helped too, but it started to have a darker frame about what the future could be.
Yeah, it certainly gets dark when we get to the flesh fair, and Of course, you know, in the 22nd century, everybody's still listening to Ministry.
I mean, I still listen to Ministry.
Are they an oldies cover band in the 22nd century?
It's classic, 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 classic rock.
I mean, and the other thing is, the Ministry song, one of them that plays here, sounds like that kind of new metal, kid rock type stuff.
No, don't compare the two.
Yeah, I didn't like this era of Ministry. Like after Psalm 69, I kind of dropped off.
Yeah, me too. But like, I do love the fact that like John Williams is having to listen to this. If you think about John Williams doing the music, the fact that he had to get into like Ministry here is kind of funny. And the way that they use the teddy bear, like the teddy bear is running around going, "Where is David? I have to find David." I'm like, this sounds like a Ministry song. "Where is David?" could be like a track on their album. It was a funny musical choice. And the Flesh Fair, it's a little obvious. It's a little on the nose. But I think, yeah, it's kind of cool to think about the idea that, yeah, we could get to this state with people feeling like, yeah, our jobs have been jeopardized so much by automation that my idea of entertainment is watching them being melted.
The thing that I found really interesting, Jacob, you'd mentioned Ex Machina, which is a movie I really liked. Here we've got Brendan Gleeson running this Flesh Fair, who is the real-life father of Domhnall Gleeson, who was in Ex Machina.
Oh, that's true. I didn't make that connection. Yeah, he's kind of a cool character. I wish he had hung around a little bit more, but he's in that fake moon. There's a whole theme in here about simulations and deception. The fact that they think they're looking at the moonrise and it's really just his blimp and his logo for the Flesh Fair. And this is how he spots the mechas and all of that. Like, you could have made this a villainous character that lasted for a little while. But like so many of the characters here, their idea is dispensed with quickly. Chris Rock popping up just for a little bit here.
Okay, I thought that was him.
I thought it was Arlie Ermey. I thought they were doing some kind of Full Metal Jacket reference, but I couldn't find his name in the credits when we see this mecca of 75 years ago, according to Time Magazine, being destroyed.
Yeah, I thought that was him too.
Maybe it is, but I could not find his name credited. So if it is, it's a secret cameo. But obviously the imagery is meant to recall another Spielberg movie, The Holocaust, right? Is this the same concept? Is this a concentration camp? Are we to think of robots? I guess the book colored my perspective because it was really an ecology problem. We had all these people that were lonely in an overpopulated world making robot children that they didn't really love, and it was just creating more and more junk. Here, I think we're supposed to think of technology more as like, because it is sentient, we need to be nicer to our can opener, right? Like, we need to treat everything with respect.
There's real life stuff going on. Like, they do studies with like Alexa. I'm sorry, I guess I just set off a bunch of people's Alexa. But like with Siri and these female voices, and they find men could like get very aggressive. Like, I've done that just joking around, like, go fuck off, bitch, or whatever, just to see what happens, see their response. But like, that is a thing. Like, you see it as a robot, as something else, as another, and you just treat it worse than you would an actual person.
Yeah. And I don't feel for like the nanny bots and things any more than I feel for my radio or something like that. And to be fair, I sometimes feel bad for my radio.
Yeah, people love their cars.
Yeah, I have a tendency to personify things where I'm like, oh, I don't want to throw that radio out. I've used it for, you know, I get a sentimental attachment.
Yeah, I have a friend who names every computer he buys.
Arnie named, or used to.
Oh, that's right. Arnie did name a computer. Christine, yeah.
Arnie still names every computer he has, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, and again, if you're getting to the point where it's harder to tell the difference between person and robot, then should they not have the rights and responsibilities of a human being then? Should they not be thought of as equal on some level? Is the sticky, you know, ground that we're trying to figure out here? And the resounding answer for Lord Johnson Johnson is, hell no. These people took our jobs. They're coming for your kids. He sees conspiracy in it. This is the man sticking to us by creating these things when they could be using us. They could be using flesh.
My thinking is David's the first one that should be worthy of it because he has emotion. And at a certain point, there's just a cruelty involved if you don't. I mean, if you believe programmed emotion is real emotion, and really, what is this movie but also a study of humanity? You know,
right.
David was created by man. Man was created by God. Are our emotions any more real than his emotions?
I guess the issue is it's not David's emotions that wins this crowd over. Like, they know he's a robot. They have this scanner where it's like an instant x-ray vision thing and you can see he's a robot, it's because he's a child and the people can't believe they made a child robot. Yeah, you don't want to kill something that looks like a child. That seems really cruel.
Yeah, Johnson does. He's like, this is, don't you see they're replacing your children? But the crowd can't go with him. Like, they actually turn and throw the rocks at him and it gives David, and because he's been grabbing onto Joe so hard, they both escape this flesh fair. A little too easy, but
yeah.
You know, like so much of this movie, we're done with this, toss it away.
And I think this is a diversion that I like the exploration of the world, but yes, if we're not going to spend more time here, if we're not going to explore the worthlessness of machines more, this was an unfulfilling side trip.
I mean, it's a stop on a road movie. I like road movies, and I think that not only are we seeing robots becoming more and more like humans, we're seeing humans becoming more and more desensitized and maybe mechanical, and that's interesting. If we're building towards that, you know, you always, Apocalypse Now, what is the summation of that journey? Where do we end up if that's where we're going? Along the way, they're going to go to Rouge City.
I do love the way they get a ride to Rouge City. Like, you have Gigolo Joe talk those young men, like, promise them all kinds of delights, and so of course they get a ride.
Including Vincent Chase. This is Adrian Grenier before Entourage. He's one of the ones, yeah, riding into the mouth of these decorative women, very Clockwork Orange.
And I thought this is surely where the Kubrick part is. Like, it's felt very Spielbergian, but yeah, when you have this ode to Clockwork Orange, I'm like, ah, Kubrick, this is what he wrote. But that's not true, I guess.
Not, I mean, it all is Kubrick. I mean, I don't think there is anything here that didn't have some fingerprints from Kubrick. I don't think Spielberg would allow someone else to put something in here that didn't feel like it came, which is why this movie feels stitched together. It's why it's not smooth and connected in the way that I would like it to feel. It's because it's a patchwork instead of a carefully designed scene-by-scene progression. But yeah, say ah, I say bah. When we finally get to see Rouge City, this feels like the shopping mall outside of Universal Studios. Like, this is not a den of vice. Like, bondage is literally a neon light.
I mean, it is the Vegas of sex cities. Like, I
it's Spielberg trying to be naughty. Like, it feels really, really tame.
It does. And being PG-13, there's only so far he can go, but he could go farther than this. I mean, the way it is sold is this hedonistic den of it. And then we get there, and the biggest thing we're going to see there is Robin Williams. That is a disappointment.
Yeah, that is strange. I do love, though, I think my favorite moment in the entire movie is the exchange they have when David thinks he's found the blue fairy.
Yes.
It's you know, the Virgin Mary in blue above the church, and Joe's just got a great monologue about the ones that made us are always looking for the ones who made them, and then when they come out of this singing their songs and whatever, they find me. That was just like a great little touch, I thought. But yeah, Robin Williams, either doing Peter Sellers' Dr. Strangelove or maybe just Einstein. I'm not sure.
I don't know that he's sure. Probably both, switching back and forth. I mean, he was never one to hold a character.
Mm-hmm. But this is kind of funny. You know, if they ever did monetize the internet, like, it probably will go this way, like $7 to Google 10 things.
Yeah, this is the part that really felt antiquated, that you'd have to go pay to get on Google and research something. Like, you don't have that on your watch or your phone.
I mean, technically, we do pay for that because we pay for the connectivity, but I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, it's not like a pay phone, though. I'm not going to drop a quarter to find out where the closest McDonald's is.
You say that, but microtransactions, I could actually believe it would go this way, where Google realizes an advertising model isn't working, and so it's a quarter per query.
Yeah, that's why I hate mobile gaming and most modern gaming, just microtransactions. Just give me the damn game. I'll pay you for the damn game. Don't make me pay thousands of dollars over years for it.
Exactly. This is why you have to pay Dr. No, K-N-O-W, so much is microtransactions.
And as we suspect, in Wizard of Oz fashion, when they get there, it doesn't give them what they think they will. They're turned away, in essence, because David's going to ask, where's the blue fairy? And he's going to get a lot of data about plants called the Blue Fairy, or a Blue Fairy escort service, or...
This is an awful internet query database. Like, you have to give it the subject first. Like, you can't just say Blue Fairy and give me some information. You got to say, like, fairy tale, now Blue Fairy. Like, you got to pick the category.
Mm-hmm. And it's very hackable, apparently, because the only reason why it's able to answer his question is because we're to find out. They had a cutaway scene where we finally go back to William Hurt and Clark Gregg for some reason, and they know that this team has escaped the Flesh Fair, and so they've rigged Dr. No to give them the information that's going to lead them to their base in New York.
So they didn't do that until they escaped the Flesh Fair? Again, I thought this was always secret information that William Hurt put out there to see if David could dream.
Well, they cut away to that. There's just this one scene in between the Flesh Fair and Joe flagging down the ride where he's like, we found him outside Haddonfield, which, by the way, is the town in Halloween. I don't know if that's a Halloween reference or not, but Clark Gregg is like, we got him. So that leads me to believe that they didn't know where he was, and then they were scrambling on how to get him. And this seems to be the plan. We recite a poem and we'll tell him that he needs to go where the lions are always crying or something like that.
Yeah, the lions weep.
Yeah, which I thought was going to be the New York Library, right?
Like, so did I. Right?
But it's some made up building with like lion fountains or something like that. So yeah, we have Joe, Teddy, and David. They've had to scramble because the cops are, we forget this, but are on the tail of Gigolo Joe. They think he's a murderer. And that's
for reasons.
Yeah. That, again, the character is just going to end up getting yanked out of the story and we'll never see a resolution to that.
Yeah, it's so weird. Again, just have him being chased because of the Flesh Fair. I don't know why you have to set up a murder.
You definitely needed to work on why Joe falls away and give him a complete arc. And, you know, if it's Wizard of Oz, they all have something that they want to get at the end of this journey. I do like the fact that he thinks he knows women. So he's like, when I find the Blue Fairy, I can fuck her brains out and she'll give you anything yeah. you want. Like,
again, his language is so great. She'll make you a real boy after I make her a real woman. You know, it's like,
yeah.
His dialogue is well written. It is a shame that he has nothing to do as a character other than spout great dialogue.
Yeah, I never forget his exchanges, though. I mean, even today, like, I mean, this aligns with a lot of the way that I think about the future of AI when he's talking about we're better. We're made better. That's why they hate us. It's because in the end, all that will be left of them is us. I mean, I do think that they are our legacy. I do think that AI eventually, mankind is not going to be around forever. I won't make predictions. Hopefully it's a long life ahead of it. But at some point, I do believe our children are what we're making.
You're saying a long time away, but now you're placing it on our children. That doesn't seem too far away.
Well, I mean, I just, you know, the talking car is my son, is my point. Like, eventually these things are going to grow up and they're going to take the best of us into the universe. And I do think that, like, Joe gets that. I do really like his character.
I think he's a realist. I think he's right that they just made them too good too fast. And in that way, it's insight for us who are strangers to this world and to David, who's a babe in the woods. But yes, he gets sucked out of it. And we get the reason I never wanted to look back at this movie, the reason I never want to revisit it, is that the last bits of this movie are so sad. Starting once they get to Rockefeller Center, when Joe leaves, oh my God, I would cry constantly when I saw this in theaters. I just couldn't stop, and neither could my wife. It is so sad from here on out.
Sad. It's sad. I wish I were having that experience. I would love to be moved by this. I feel like it's a total mess. This is where, like, I was having problems with the movie, but I was largely with it. And once we get to this Manhattan explanation, it's so important. This is like the Zardos moment,
yeah,
or the Planet of the Apes moment, where we're going to finally get to the answers about what this was all about. I'm like, I don't even understand what's happening at this point.
Yeah, there's an assembly line, like they're mass producing David's all of a sudden. What William Hurt's going to tell us feels the exact opposite of commoditizing these robots. I wanted to build something that dreams and can discover and all that. But no, you got a mass production of David's and Darlene's.
And why would you give them all the same faces? I mean, parents want their child to be unique. You don't want to go to a Walmart and see 10 twins.
I guess African-Americans don't get black children for their own.
Yeah, all of these are great points. But even more important than that, never forget the fact that the directive was the mom was supposed to take him back to the factory and they were going to burn David. So if he's walking back, there he is. Why are they leaving him alone? Like, William Hurt is like, let me go get the design team. And we never see him again. He's just gone from the movie. What are you talking about? Like, this is where I feel like Spielberg, he knows what a good story is. So he knows that it's needed, but he doesn't feel right creating something that Kubrick didn't discuss with him, would be my guess. And so he includes the details that they talked about, and he omits anything that would be connective material. And so we have this movie that is just shattered glass now all over, just cutting me as I'm trying to figure out what's going on.
There is one effect in this movie that creates a problem for me, and it is here after William Hurt leaves and when David is just exploring and finds that room of David's. The mannequins are just Haley Joel Osment enough, but not quite. So I'm actually saying, are they all supposed to look like him? And finally in the background, I see one that has a real facial expression. I'm like, okay, so yes, these are all him. But I didn't get that instantly from these mannequins hanging around.
Again, there's only one of, he says, I thought it was one of a kind. Well, you're the first of a kind is kind of what he's anointed at. These are all the failed versions. I mean, keep in mind, he like gets there and the first thing he sees is one that's pretty close to him wearing his little white tunic, and he gets to beat the shit out of and break.
I thought these were all the later ones. I thought this was an assembly line.
They're like on meat hooks. So yeah, I thought it was an assembly line.
Don't get confused. There's the ones in the boxes that are going to be mass produced, but all of the things that are you're talking about that don't quite look like him are earlier ideas and models.
Oh,
I didn't get that. I thought these were ones waiting for parts to be put in and then they'd be put in a box.
Yeah, because we see David look through that one. He looks through the eyes and you see that human with the feathers, that his first memory. So I just took it as this is where they were assembled for some reason in flooded Manhattan. It seemed weird.
Even weirder because at the beginning, William Hurt called them the New Jersey team. Did it like sail over or something like this? Bill is clearly Manhattan. They're going to end up in Coney Island just beneath. So maybe things have happened in the water. I don't know, but geography is swirling around here. You were moved by the fact that he commits suicide now. I mean, of course, that's sad. A child's killing himself. But like, I was more confused.
Yeah, I'm with you, Stuart. I don't understand it.
No, I was, I mean, in theaters, I was sad and I would just get sadder. But I was so sad because this kid was just so idealistic and all he wanted was love. And now he's killing himself.
Here's where I'm really going to praise Haley Joel Osment. I thought he was fine. I didn't think it was exceptional in the way I thought he was in Sixth Sense. But the fact that he like goes underwater here and never blows a bubble. I don't know how the hell he had that control. Like, he has a shot that's at least 20 seconds long.
Well, are they actually underwater? I know they could fake that.
Oh, no. He said, I learned to scuba dive for this, and I had like a secret air hose, and they left me under there for hours. And he just learned how to like have that stare and never let bubbles come out of his mouth or nose. I believe it. He never looks like he's breathing.
Yeah, we'll see it. He sees something, and then Gigolo Joe comes down, saves him. Joe gets pulled away, and then he just goes back under the water, right?
Yeah, but he's in the hovercraft that Joe had saved him with.
And this is where I wish the movie ended, him just staring at the blue fairy. There's another half hour, though.
Oh, my God, though, with the, please make me a real boy. Please let my mother love me. I was bawling in theaters, man. That's harsh.
So that's a good thing. I mean, again, that's high praise. That's the best a movie could do, is to hit you at that level. So you're loving this.
Yeah, it's dark and sad, and I wish it ended there. But no, I remember people wondering if these were aliens or not. It's obvious if you watch it, they're not aliens, but they do kind of look like aliens when they first show up.
I thought they were aliens when I saw this in theaters, and until I watched it this time. I mean, because they look so much like those Close Encounters aliens.
Yes.
I just thought, we get the voiceover, 2,000 years have passed. I just thought aliens came to Earth in 2,000 years.
Yeah, well, that is what it is, right?
No, they're AI.
I mean, it's obvious because we'll see them controlling David with their hands, kind of like Joe could do with the radio.
I got to laugh, though. Like, this movie thought, like, we're showing you so far in the future. The Twin Towers are standing. Oops, guys, you got, like, outdated in 3 months after this movie came out.
That was a little hard to see them sticking out of the ice.
And I do want to say, I want to take back, these AI aliens, whatever, do look a little bit dated with their CGI. I wish there was more practical with them.
All right, yeah, you're right.
Here's the thing, though. I you're not the first person to tell me you wish the movie ended with him just like he was in the pool, just arms outstretched, trapped in that forever needing position he was always going to be in. Because at some point, even if the mom didn't reject him, she would die and he would still want her. It is Kubrick's pattern to always bring it full circle. If you think about it, Dave had to be reborn as the star child. Little Alex had to revert back to his criminal self. You want Jack Nicholson to be absorbed back into the past and be a part of the hotel. Like, you have to bring David back to his mom. In some way, you have to write it that he does get reunited and meet the Blue Fairy and have that exchange. I don't know if it needs to have these weird qualifiers. First of all, I just want to say I want the Teddy spinoff, if only to understand why he has the strand of hair. Why the fuck is he going around collecting hair strands?
Yeah, we saw him pick it up when David cut it, but he's held on to it. I guess he was frozen for 2,000 years, so...
Why do that? He ripped a hole in himself, sewed it up to keep the hair in there.
Oh, is that why he was sewing himself? I just thought he got torn and he was repairing himself.
I don't know. Maybe the spinoff movie is Ted. I don't know. I've never seen that movie, but this bear is super interesting and kinky and weird, and I want to get... What is going on with the damn bear? But because they have all of these silly rules, again, it would be sad. The feeling is sad. You're absolutely right. To see that much pleading and the Oedipal complex is so profound and, again, metaphorical. This is, and since he became self-aware, he's been wondering, does my creator love me? Will God ever come back for me? This stuff is primal. It should mean a lot, but blah, 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 blah. Cut all this dialogue.
What I find hilarious is these AIs, they're like, oh, we found this connection to flesh humans and us in our whatever bodies they are of wires and robotics. We can't understand the purpose of life. That's something connected to flesh. So maybe you could help. Like, humanity has a real good grip on what the purpose of life is and our destiny. Like, there's not religious wars that have been going on the entire history of humanity because of disagreements over this. Like, this is where it just gets kind of silly to me.
Yeah, well, they make it a Jurassic Park. Now we're the dinosaurs, right? Like, we can bring them back, but only for like a day. I'm not sure what.
A day, yeah. Because there's something to the conscious time stream continuum or some gobbledygook.
All I know is this is probably the last time anyone ever has asked to see Francis O'Connor again. It's like, all right, here's your literally your last day. All right, come out here, chick. Somebody likes you, and it's David.
See, and for me, I went with some of this stuff, but is any of this really happening? Because we cut away and we see those future AIs. I get the impression that they have disembodied both Teddy and David at this point. They've uploaded their consciousness into some computer.
I was wondering if that was going to be a reveal, because it does seem like it's going to play that way. But I don't know why you come up with this crazy science that we could resurrect someone for a day if it's just in your brain. Yeah, make it forever. Let them be comatose like Martin was and have this happy dream.
And you say come full circle, Stuart. See, here's what I see is that at the beginning of this movie, man created machine, but the machine was imperfect, and the machine was not able to completely fulfill what man can do, and now we fast forwarded, and machine is making man. And that is the circle I see, is this weird circle of life, how
yep.
Now they can build us the way we built them, but now the humans are imperfect.
Great irony, but you gotta write it, is what I keep thinking about a lot of this stuff. Like, all these ideas, this is what you call a draft, a story idea. But this is the fact that this is the final version, and we've got Ben Kingsley monologuing for literally like 10, 15 minutes. I mean, like, no, you can't have an audience sit there. This needed to be quick. You needed to get to the tears. We want to get to the sad part. Like, we don't need all of this exposition. It's just a killer. It's a mood killer.
But yet, they need to set up that they can only bring her back for a day. Now, it's a story contrivance, right? They just don't want him to have her mother. My memory was that he got locked at the end in a simulation where he thought he had his mother, but it was an artificial construct. I mean, I hadn't seen this film in 20 years. That's kind of what I remembered. But that they have this perfect day, but she can kind of not remember. I mean, they never mention Henry. They never mention the other son.
Yeah, she's foggy with what she can remember.
Yeah, and again, he wants it that way. He never wanted any of it. He's like, this is the best day ever because they're not involved. I only wanted you, so...
And Monica throws him a birthday because he doesn't really have one. I do think it's telling. She's like, make a wish. He blows out the candles. One doesn't go out. Like, we know what his wish is, to be a real boy, to be with his mommy forever. And the fact that that candle doesn't go out, I don't know. I thought that was a nice little touch there that he's not going to get that wish.
I don't know if this was Kubrick's ending. I don't know enough. I suppose people can go in the archives and find out. But
Spielberg says it was. Spielberg says that people blame him for this ending. But this was all Kubrick. And when I think about 2001, I see it. You know, the fact that we did jump through time that much in that movie, I kind of can see that.
Oh, yeah. No, I was going to guess it's not even Kubrick's ending. It's David Lynch's. I mean, I know Kubrick loved David Lynch, and this feels like the end of The Elephant Man. If you remember, he just wanted to sleep in his bed and like have his mom and all of that. Like, it's the same ending, except I did cry at The Elephant Man, and this... It's just been too messy. Like, getting here has taken a lot out of me.
I'll say this. This time, I didn't cry. I felt a little sad when I thought of some of the implications. And again, I'm equating David to a puppy. And this puppy just wants to be loved. And that makes me very sad because he's a stupid dog. But yes, I'm seeing these problems. I'm not weeping on this watching. But here, again, I wonder if David is in a simulation, because when his mother goes to sleep at night slash dies, he cries. Tears come out of his eyes. We've never seen him able to do that.
I think the point is, and I don't care whether it's simulation or real. I agree, it's arguable and nebulous, and I'm so mad at this movie anyway, I don't really care. But the point is, he's real, and he can actually go to sleep. Remember, he's like, I can lie in a bed, but I never actually sleep. He's going to be able to dream now with his mom and cry tears. So he has had an arc. He has changed. He has been, through the power of AI and Blue Fairy and some bad writing, he has become a real boy.
But it all happened here at the very end, and not through his own actions he's acted upon. He still feels like a static character to me. And does he die at the end? Does he just fall asleep? I mean, I take it that the only way he could be happy is if he died with her. And so maybe he shut himself down internally or something at that moment.
No, he's going to the place of dreams.
Yeah, heaven.
Yeah. I agree. That's probably, again, it's where we're going to meet our maker, right? Like, I mean, I feel like there's something to extract about the way we think about our creator and Mother Earth or whatever. So, yes, he has died. That is the way that I take it. But he's died real.
Well, that's a real pisser for those advanced robots who really wanted to pick his brain about what humans were like.
Again, they may have already done that. I don't know what they wanted. Don't get me started.
No, continue, please.
I don't like any of that. Like, it's just bad. Like, you have to do better than that. That is not acceptable as an ending.
Well, is it acceptable as a film? Jacob Stewart, do you recommend AI, Artificial Intelligence? Jacob.
We all have biases when we go into a film, and I've talked about, I don't like sentimentality, and even when we talked about E.T., a Spielberg movie that I really like, by the end, I'm like, okay, go home, E.T., I get it, everyone loves you, we're all crying, okay, you can leave now, we don't need to keep pulling on these heartstrings, I want it a little bit more challenging, and I do feel like Spielberg, with his family films, especially, like that's the thing that I kind of rub up against as an adult now, is that sentimentality, and there's a lot of that in this, and yet, there's something I like about this film. And Stuart, I understand your disdain and your dislike that I've heard throughout this review. You could write this off as being stupid, but I like that it is this big, wide, yeah, it's a clumsy film. It's fragmented. It feels like it's created by two different people with different visions, and one's trying to honor Kubrick and all that. It's not a well-constructed film, but there's so many ideas and so many visuals that I am drawn to. That's why I feel like I still need to be David, and I need to just stand in front of this film maybe for 2,000 years till I could really, like, sort out my feelings, because, yeah, bad storytelling at times. I hate the last half hour of this film. I wish it ended with David under the water, frozen, staring at the Blue Fairy. I in fact, don't like any of that Pinocchio metaphor. It just, you take a metaphor, and now you've made it literal, and that's not fun. That's why metaphors are fun, because they're metaphors. So, yeah, there's a lot of complaints, and yet, I think there are a lot of, again, sprinkling of ideas that I do really get into throughout this film. Like, what are the ethics towards robots and those kind of things, which with big, heady, idea-filled sci-fi, like that, I like that kind of stuff. Even when they are clumsy and they're not maybe great films, I'm still, you know, if you want to say the word entertained, or I'm still involved and engaged by them. And so I found myself, again, not a great film, I was still engaged by it. And so I was able to get over my Spielberg biases towards sentimentality and a lot of things I didn't like here. And look, if that Blue Fairy stuff is Kubrick's fault, then I blame Kubrick. But yeah, because of the ideas and because of the just moments, the shots, again, David under the water in the pool and just Jude Law as the giant moon is rising. All that stuff that Spielberg could bring to a film, I think is great here. And I do like the ideas. It's a very weak recommend, but I think if you like sci-fi because you just like to think what could be in the future, this has got some seedlings for you that you could run with. I could see why someone would watch this over the years and just revisit those ideas. So again, weak recommend. Not a perfect film, not a great film, but it's good enough.
Stuart.
Now, you know, human beings in general, I think, can be kind of judgmental, but usually eulogies are off limits. You know, generally we let people say goodbye to loved ones however they need to. You know, many times they get up there, they say inappropriate off-color things, and you're like, oh my God, but that's what Uncle Henry had to say, and he did it his way. Okay. AI is how Spielberg needed to say goodbye to Kubrick. He did not want to see this great man's work and everything that they did together go into the back of a drawer. It was better to produce an imperfect, unfinished film than it was to see this die on the vine. And I agree. There are a lot of interesting ideas that I would hate to see to go to waste. It would be a shame not to know what they were working on for all of this time. But if you told me a robot made this movie, I'd believe you. And I would send it off for reprogramming or being melted. I mean, I do think the manner in which this story is told is very clunky. And none of the performances are really that great other than Jude Law. I mean, even Haley Joel Osment he's fine, but it's kind of what I would expect. Other than the fact that he didn't breathe underwater, I was like, all right, whatever. I don't care about David that much. Jude Law was cool. Teddy should have his own spinoff. But yeah, it wasn't very interesting as a vision of the future. A lot of it was backward looking at Kubrick's career or Blade Runner. And I list this kind of thing as an interesting failure.
I think this is what you said with Eyes Wide Shut.
Totally. And I'm giving it the same review. Like, Kubrick fans need to see it. Of course, if you are a fan of Kubrick, Green Arrow for you. But I tend to make the color of my arrows my actual opinion of the finished product. And this is very unfulfilling. It is as unfulfilling as Eyes Wide Shut. That's Red Arrow. So, I mean, again, I really like some of it. I hope I didn't come off too harsh. A bad Kubrick movie is better than most people's masterpieces. Hear what I'm saying. It's an interesting failure.
And I came back to this reluctantly. And Marjorie had very similar feelings to me. When I was watching this film, you know, COVID, isolated home, she was home while I watched it. Anytime she had to come out into the area where I was watching this, she'd text me and make me pause the movie. She didn't want to see a frame of it, didn't want to hear it. She wore noise-blocking headphones. She did everything she could to avoid this movie because her memory was just so sad.
Can I ask, what you're really saying is because it hurt you so deeply? Not that it was a bad movie. You didn't want to go back and feel pain like this.
But I also remember being very dissatisfied with the movie itself. Like, I felt like it hurt, but certain movies you can have hurt you, but yet they're really good movies, and so you can endure. And this, I remember the Jude Law stuff being real messy and the stuff at the Flesh Fair. I just had flash memories of all this and remembering it feeling half-formed. And coming back to it, I don't think I was wrong in that, actually. I do think a lot of that stuff is half-formed. A lot of this stuff feels shoehorned in. But I was surprised coming back at how well I do feel some of this is made on a technical level. I mean, I like John Williams' score a lot, even though it does remind me a lot of the score he'd do for Attack of the Clones the very next year. I do like the effects of this a lot. I like the ideas that are raised. I just wish they did more with them. I mean, I like Jude Law's character. I wish he had a purpose in David's story. I like David and the family. I wish that they'd slowed down a little bit so I could have spent more time and gotten to know them.
Oh, yeah. I'm with you.
So there's stuff in here I definitely like and performances I like. But yeah, I find this movie to be very messy. And once David begins this road trip, it threatens to fall apart. And then the ending is so out of left field. You know, I mean, watching it the second time, it's still not an ending that they're building up to. They never even hint at machines making machines.
Yeah, I mean, I think you explained it. I mean, I think it ended up being that the shoe's on the other foot now. Like, that's, I think you nailed that. What we're looking at is the creature from the beginning that was just a statue. An idea in a creator's mind has now become the thing, yeah, trying to start Humanity Park.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like that's where the movie is going. I think there should have been something set up of a second-gen AI or something like that so that it didn't feel so crazy when what I thought were aliens the first time around came out. But all things considered, I think this movie is interesting, and I did find a lot in it that I enjoyed watching a second time. Coming back to it, it was far better than I remembered, and it's enough where I can give it a weak recommend.
No, well, I'm surprised.
I am too, believe me.
Yeah, you're usually the stickler for tight storytelling.
I am, but this one, I feel like it had ideas there that I liked. And remember, I said the same thing about 2001 also, which did not have tight storytelling, but I thought it had some cool things going on visually and some cool ideas, and I kind of put this in a similar vein.
Yeah, it does. It definitely does. I feel like Spielberg took all of these ideas, though, and made a better movie, his next film. I feel like Minority Report is the Kubrick homage he was trying to make with this more entertaining.
Now I feel I have to revisit that one because I have only seen it a couple times and my memory was certainly a not recommend.
And then you can listen to our review in the archives.
I've listened to that many times.
But I promise you, next time, June patrons, it's a movie that doesn't make Arnie cry. In fact, it makes him laugh a lot. It's taken years.
It makes me cry with tears of happiness that we're reviewing it.
Are we doing Soul Man finally?
No, almost. Save it for another month.
Oh, I know what it
is.
Yeah,
come on. If we're not going to get Top Gun 2, we need our Val Kilmer fix. We need a real genius.
Ah, we're finally doing it.
Absolutely.
Oh, man. I feel so happy.
I saw it. I remember liking it in 1985 in theaters. It was a long time ago.
I didn't see it in theaters, surprisingly. I've never had that joy, but I've seen it so many times since. It's got a great soundtrack. It's got some funny lines. It's got some good performances. It's got some actors that you'll know from other things that you can't believe are in this movie.
I only remember God speaking through the guy's braces and telling him to stop whacking off. That's it. I think there are nukes, though, right? It's the 80s. There had to be like a nuclear thing.
Lasers. There's no nukes. It's lasers.
Lasers and popcorn.
Okay.
It's certainly going to be something. I feel like I've pledged my money so that we can discuss it. But Stuart just brought it up as a Top Gun 2 replacement. And I'm like, yes, let's talk some Val.
Sure. I'm game.
So before we go, Ed, thank you so much for your support, and hopefully you've enjoyed this review. And to all of our patrons who have donated month after month, we hope you've enjoyed this review as well and learned something about AI. I know I learned some stuff from your research, Stuart. I didn't realize about the sequel stories and things. So thank you for all of that.
You bet. Yeah, it was quite a journey. And again, I hope you hear me. I may not share your enthusiasm about the movie, Mr. Powell, but I get why you're into it.
So until next time, we are, we were.
You won't understand the reasons, but I have to leave you here.
Is it a game? When will you come back for me?
I'm not, David. You'll have to be here by yourself.
Oh?
No, 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 no. No, Mommy, please, no, no.
Thank you to all the listeners who have backed us through our Podbean crowdfunding campaign. and we hope you've enjoyed this special bonus movie review podcast.
How did that make you feel? Angry? Shocked?
I don't understand.
Without patrons such as yourself, we couldn't keep doing the shows we put out every single Tuesday. So thanks to you all.
Quality control is very important.
And we want to wish a special thank you to Ed Powell for his tremendous support of our show and for picking AI Artificial Intelligence for this patron-exclusive review.
Thank you, Mommy. Thank you so much.
If you enjoy Now Playing, please head to iTunes and leave us a 5-star listing. It's the best way to help spread the word about the podcast.
In this day and age, David, nothing costs more than information.
You can follow Now Playing on Facebook and Twitter, where we post announcements of new episodes and where the hosts post movie mini reviews. Links to our social media pages are available on our homepage.
Can you sit down and we can read together? Let's be friends.
Now Playing Podcast is produced by Arnie Carvalho.
He's a smooth operator. He'll press our limits, but try we must.
Associate produced by Jason Latham.
You are one of a kind. You know that?
Now Playing is edited by Steven and Arnie.
You will break.
Now Playing credits read by Brock.
Now, I'm gonna read some words. And, they won't make any sense, but I want you to listen to them anyway.
The opinions expressed on Now Playing are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the opinion of Venganza Media Incorporated.
See how they try to imitate our emotions now?
Venganza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with the motion pictures reviewed or otherwise referred to herein.
Don't ever let them catch you!
All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review and no infringement is intended.
I'm afraid.
Of me?
Yes.
That I will hurt you?
Yes.
Now Playing Podcast is an exclusive trademark of Venganza Media Incorporated and may not be used without the expressed written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
Dearest David, your wish is my command.
Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2020, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
Goodbye, Sam. And never forget, you killed me first.
I mean, if it's a sex bot, there's other things that are going to be on the innards.
Yeah, exactly. You have a tank, right? It gets cleaned out. Not hard to do.
I mean, that's what they do with real dolls now.
Mm-hmm. Oh, God. They have a tank?
Well, they clean them out so they don't deteriorate.
Oh, God.
You could send them to companies that will, clean them out and retouch their nails and hair and everything.
Oh, my God. Anyway, back to this. I do not want to even think about that.
So no Lars and the Real Girl retrospective anytime soon?
You know, it's just whatever people want to do with their privates. But, you know, to me, it's the same as, you know, it's... Anyway.
Yes.
So